So, before we jump right into any proposal being met, I want to quickly recap and sort of get an idea from the last lecture, which was quantum spectral curve, or SU2 of iceberg spin chain. So we had some Hamiltonian H, which commuted with SU2 global SU2 spin generators. Oh.
Is it okay? So we had some Hamiltonian, which commuted with SU2 spin generators. And the point was that eigenspaces of this Hamiltonian corresponded to irreps of SU2. Okay, and then the main point of the quantum spectral curve was that we had some QQ relation, almost exactly the same as the one from the previous talk, if you attended that, which in this case simply said that we had some Q12 as a function of U was equal to Q1 of U plus I over 2, Q2 of U minus I over 2, minus Q1 of U minus I over 2, Q2 of U plus I over 2, together with a boundary condition, which told us that this Q12 was just equal to U to the L, where L was the number of sites on the spin chain, together with the fact that this Q1 and Q2 a polynomial. And there was a one-to-one correspondence between solutions of this Q system obeying these analytic properties and eigenspaces of this Hamiltonian. And the precise map between the irreducible representations and these Q functions was encoded, or at least partly encoded, in the asymptotics of these Q functions, namely for that. So how does this one work? Does this just push up? Okay. Okay, perfect. So namely that for some SU2 irrep, which had some highest weight SZ, which was equal to L over 2 minus S, where again L is the length of the spin chain, then for the irreducible representation with the highest weight, we had that Q1 asymptotically was some constant A1 times U to the S, and Q2 was A2 U to the L plus 1 minus S. Okay, so the key points that we'll take from this and we'll generalize to n equals 4 super Young Mills is, first of all, we have some functions which we call Q, which carry some indices which satisfy some relations like this. There is some boundary condition, there is some quantization condition on these functions, and once this quantization condition is satisfied, we have a one-to-one correspondence between solutions of this system and what will turn out to be irreducible representations of the superconformal group of n equals 4 super Young Mills. Okay. So, quantum spectral curve for planar super young nodes. So in the case of the Heisenberg spin chain, we have this global SU2 symmetry. So what is the analog of this? Well, global symmetry in this case is PSU(2,2)/4, which is a real form of SL(4/4). And we saw in the previous lecture that changing essentially the real form of the algebra didn't really change much. If we worked with SU2 or SL2, then the QQ relations were exactly the same. All that changes was the analytic structure of the functions involved. So what we need to do to generalize this is to write down a QQ system of equations for SL(4/4).
Why is it not PSL? Why is it not PSL(4/4)?
We want unitarity. Or do you mean something? Maybe I don't fully understand your question.
I mean, this is the complex dimension of SL(4/4) is one bigger than the real dimension of PSU(2,2)/4.
Sorry, the complex dimension of what?
SL(4/4) is one dimension bigger.
One dimension bigger than which?
Than PSU(2,2)/4. Tensor bit C. Sorry, it's a dumb question.
No, I don't think I fully understand the question. So you're talking about PSL? So why do you talk about PSL?
Because, you know, if it was, you know, SL3 and PSL3 have the same Lie algebra,
mm-hmm.
but because it's a supergroup, it's trace-free.
Yes.
So there's a difference between SL and PSL.
Difference between SL and PL?
Yeah, I mean, don't worry about it. I mean, I noticed.
Okay, I mean, I'll show you exactly how this. Well, maybe it will also cause more problems, but I'll show you how this. I mean, I will explain why this is. How I interpreted PSU in the language of the QQ system instead of just SL. And then, if there are further problems, I guess we can discuss later.
It's just some terminology problem.
So okay, so to write this thing down, so we need some. We'll have more QQ relations than before, so we're going to need some notation. So first of all, let's have a set numbers B of 1, 2, 3, 4, and another set F, which is also 1, 2, 3, 4, but I do want to distinguish them. So B for bosonic and F for fermionic. And now I want to denote by capital A a subset of these bosonic indices, and small a and small b will be elements of these bosonic indices. And similarly, capital I will be a subset of these fermionic indices, and small I and small j will be elements of these fermionic indices. Okay, so now I can write down these QQ relations. So before, we were just dealing with these functions Q, where we had indices 1, 2, 1, and 2. So this quantum spectral curve, or this QQ system, is formulated on functions Q, A, slash, I of U. Okay, where A is some subset of these bosonic indices, F is, I is a subset of the fermionic indices, and I have this convention that Q of the empty set with the empty set is just 1, which is just essentially a normalization condition. Okay, so now in full gore, we can write down what these QQ relations are. We will not use them, thankfully, but they will motivate what we do. And by seeing them, you will be thankful that we don't use them. So Q, big A, small a, B. This means I take some subset A of my bosonic indices. I take 2 elements of my bosonic indices, and I just attach these to my set A. So this is some, this strictly speaking means A union AB, okay, with any fermionic subset, and then Q A slash I, and this is equal to, and let me remind you, by the way, the notation we had from the previous one, which was that for some function F of U, we had this notation F plus minus U, and was defined to be F of U plus minus I over 2. Okay, so we're going to use this. So this is equal to Q A A slash I plus Q A B slash I minus U, and then anti-symmetrize by swapping this plus and minus. So I mean, now on this side I have Q A small a slash I minus Q A B plus I. Q A A slash.
That is the argument U, right? It's just making the equation that way. You already defined everything.
Ah, sorry, yeah. Yeah. Well, uglier than it already is, yeah. So. Well, okay, at the end of the day, for n equals 4 super Young meals, you'll have to solve these equations for 256 different Q functions. I don't want to do that. So Q A slash II is Q A slash II plus Q A slash I minus, and then again, anti-symmetrize plus and minus. And finally, the last one, QA slash I, IJ, QA slash I is equal to QA slash big I, little I, plus QA slash IJ, minus, and then anti-symmetrize, plus with minus again. Okay, so this is a system of finite difference equations for, as I said, 256. Different Q functions, QA slash I. And to solve the system, you need to solve for all of these functions, which sounds like a complete nightmare, but thankfully, you don't need to in practice solve all of them. There's a special generating set of these Q functions, which are particularly nice. You solve those, and then through these relations, you can reconstruct all other functions.
Sorry, what is the status of this equation? So it's a generalization of what we had last lecture, or?
It's a generalization of what we had last lecture. So in the last lecture, the point is that this fermionic set of indices was just the empty set, so there's nothing. And this set of bosonic indices was just one with two. And then there's just a single relation, the first one, where A would correspond to the empty set, A and B are 1 and 2, and this will perfectly reproduce this relation. So it's a generalization of this relation for higher rank.
And it can also be derived from algebraic beta ansatz, yes?
Yeah, so I mean, from the point of view of algebraic beta ansatz, these Qs, the fact that we have more Qs, corresponds that we have different levels of nesting in the beta ansatz.
And they also correspond to generating function of some eigenvalues of something, or beta roots.
So basically all of these Q functions correspond to some collection of beta roots, generating function of some collection of beta roots, yeah.
And all of them are equally important, or there are more important ones and less important ones?
To some extent, depending on the type of representation you look at, some would be more important. So for example, if I did a spin chain, then this Q1 slash empty, this would correspond to the beta roots of the first level of nesting. Then if I go to more excitations, I would have Q12 slash empty, and so on, and I build the hierarchy of nesting. But then once you've made this choice, you of course have this Weyl group symmetry where you can change indices. For example, you could choose a different vacuum to make excitations around. This would correspond to maybe using Q2 or Q3, and so on.
And so far, no information about spin or length of chain was not...
So far, absolutely nothing of this is included. This is just a definition for an SL4/4 spin chain. It would take this generic form. All information about the concrete integral model, length, inhomogeneity, spin, and so on, this will enter into the analytic properties of the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, this one doesn't move. Okay. So, in practice, we just need a few of these Q functions, so we're going to introduce some notation for these special ones. We will call P A, which is Q A with the empty set, so no fermionic indices. So this A is equal to 1, 2, 3, and 4. And unfortunately, writing on a blackboard, the distinction is not completely clear, but I will try to make it clear. Something which is just called Q, and I will try to write it more like an actual Q with a single index R, which is this Q with no bosonic indices, but a single fermionic indices. So the point is that with these 4 plus 4 equals 8 Q functions, we can generate all other Q functions by just iteratively using this system of equations. In practice, this will, of course, be kind of complicated. You might need to solve some finite difference equations along the way. For example, the next simplest guy, which is kind of important, is this QA slash I. And if you look at the second equation where this A is the empty set, capital A is the empty set, I is the empty set, and then A and I are all that's left, this will actually give you the following, which is QAI plus minus Q A slash I minus is equal to PA, and I need to be careful with my notation, QI. So once you give me these P's and Q's, I can in principle go and solve this finite difference equation and iteratively reconstruct all Q functions in this way. Okay? So where does PSU enter the game? So what I really want to focus on in this P, and when you try to construct the integrable spin chain, which would correspond to this, you can realize that this P corresponds to a special boundary condition. Which is that the Q function corresponding to all indices, so this Q 1, 2, 3, 4, slash 1, 2, 3, 4 is simply equal to 1. So the corresponding statement in the Heisenberg spin chain was that this Q with all indices, which was just Q 1, 2 in that case, was simply U to the power L of the spin chain, whereas now this is equal to 1. And sort of the reason why this is because this Q with all indices is somehow related to a group element determinant or quantum determinant in like the Yangian language and should be equal to 1 when we impose this P condition.
And by default, we assume that Q empty empty is also 1.
Yes. So now we have two guys who are both 1, Q empty empty and Q full full.
So you made a comment about the different A indices like labeling some kind of vacuum. Could you clarify that point?
So if you consider if you just consider say SU3 Heisenberg spin chain. So the usual way that you would build like the spin chain eigenstates or diagonalize Hamiltonians through the beta ansatz, to do this you identify some vacuum state. Okay, there's some state which is not excited, and you start to build excitations around this vacuum. So when you're doing this, for an SU3 spin chain, you proceed sort of in levels of nesting, like in an iterative procedure. So you start from the lowest level, you build excitations. This gives you a collection of beta roots. These beta roots are encoded in some Q function, in a Q function with just a single index. So in this case, just say QA or something like this. Now when you go to the next level of nesting, you start building excitations around this state. And this gives you another collection of beta roots. These are sort of like auxiliary in some sense. And these beta roots will be encoded in another set of Q functions with two indices, and so on.
So you could have started from, so if you have 1 and 2, you could have started from 1 and then gotten to 1, 2, or 2, and then gotten to 1.
Yeah, you can do this. So this corresponds to having a global SUN or like SU2 symmetry where you can choose different vacuums, and depending on which vacuum you start from, different Q functions would be excited, and so on. More questions?
Also, equivalently, you could have, instead of defining PA with as QA phi, you could have defined A 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Because that's also.
I could have defined what?
So it seems like there's a symmetry between the vacuum phi and 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes.
So you could start from the other direction?
Yeah, sure, you can. Yeah. This is actually. So what is normally done is that you introduce another distinguished set of Q functions, which would be, for example, P with an upper index A. Mm-hmm. And this is defined to be, epsilon tensor, say A complement A, P Q A complement phi, where this A complement denotes the complement of A in 1, 2, 3, 4. This is sort of like a Hodge dual of these P's. And in fact, in general, if you look at quantum spectral curve for N equals 4 super Young Mills in full generality, these guys play an equally important role as these P's. But for the specific SL2 sector that I'm going to consider, these P upper A's are essentially just equal to these P lower A's, which is why I'm not going to introduce these or make any focus on these. But yeah, exactly, you can do this. Yeah. Okay, so once this condition is satisfied, you end up with one extra relation, which in general is not present, but I'm going to write it down because it would be very useful for us. And of course, I'm not going to prove this because there is no time to prove anything in this. You just have to take my word on these things. But what you can show is that actually this Q with a lower index I can be written as minus QA slash I with plus or minus indices P upper A. And actually, it's a good idea that good thing that I introduced this because it plays a role here. So what this means is that actually you don't need to consider all of these P's and all of these Q's, but actually it's enough to consider the P's, and from the P's you can reconstruct the entire system. So in the language of N equals 4 super Young Mills, what people actually do in practice is write some suitable ansatz for these P's, which take into account all the relevant analytic structure and so on. And once those P's are solved, you get a unique solution for the system, and you can read off the observable you're interested in, which in this case would be the conformal dimension of the irreducible representation you're looking at.
Sorry, how could this equation be true with plus and minus?
It is true with plus and minus.
No, that's
it is.
There's a sum over A. Sorry.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah, there's a sum over A. Yes. Yeah, so I will assume Einstein notation and sum over repeated indices. Yeah?
What's the Q on the left? This QI?
This QI is this notation here where it's Q.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to make sure. Okay.
Yeah.
You change your font. Yeah.
I mean, if I'm writing LaTeX, I can have like this Q is like boldface Q. But here, I mean.
Okay, so if there's only one index without bar, it will be also.
Yeah, absolutely. If it's one index on Q without bar, it's exactly this guy. But this confusion will go away because my point here is that I can write everything at the level of P's and I'm never going to need to use like this Q. But yeah. Okay.
Sorry, just to clarify.
Yes.
So this P upper index A that you defined, which is kind of like, as you said, the Hodge dual.
Yeah.
But so you're not changing the argument, right? Because these are functions in U.
Yes.
Yeah, but like when you take the dual, you're not actually changing the argument, because I thought you might want to like go from positive modes to negative modes or something.
No, I'm not changing the argument. So this is, it's precisely this definition. So this P upper index A is defined in terms of these lower guys through this.
Okay.
All at the same rapidity U. And I'll have something else to say about this upper P in a moment. Which will simplify our lives, but okay. From there, we are ready to write down the thing for N equals 4. And as I said, so for this lecture, it will just be a case of writing definitions and looking at consequences of those, and then in the next one, we actually put everything into practice and solve the thing super explicitly and solve these P's super explicitly. Okay, so in the case of the SU2 spin chain, we saw that these Q's had a really nice analytic structure, namely they were polynomial. So what happens when we go to N equals 4 super Young Mills? Well, the most important distinction from the case of just a spin chain is that these Q functions live on a Riemann surface. Of infinite genus. And in general, all of these Q functions have an infinite number of branch points. Located at plus minus 2g, and I'll say what g is in a moment, plus in where n is an integer, and no other singularities. And finally, that all branch points are quadratic. Meaning we go around the branch point twice, we come back to where we started. Okay, so what is this G? So this G is just some continuous parameter that the analytic properties of this integral system depend on. So I have some continuous parameter in my theory. What continuous parameter does planar n equals 4 Cyprian-Mills have? Coupling constant, the Dukes coupling. So this G is square root lambda over 4 pi, where lambda is the Dukes coupling of n equals 4. Okay, so what's really quite remarkable is that this is the only place in the entire construction where the coupling constant actually enters. It just tells you the position of the branch points. Okay, so now we will start to draw some pictures.
So, but a general question. Is it possible to say what quantity in n equals 4 q will compute, or is this too hard to say?
So if you look at it from the point of view of the spin chain, right? So in the spin chain, you have, of course, some infinite dimensional algebra. And what these Qs do is essentially correspond to eigenvalue equations for some commutative subalgebra. So, of course, we believe that there is some corresponding infinite dimensional algebra describing n equals 4 Cyprian-Mills at finite Dukes coupling, and that correspondingly, these Qs should just be eigenvalue equations for a commutative subalgebra in that. What exactly it's computing, if you want to have a precise map where you map Q function to, for example, three-point function, that's the whole point of this series, which we'll see tomorrow. But for example, other observables, for example, the conformal dimension, we will see in a moment how that actually enters the game.
Thanks.
And I'm presenting this so that everything corresponds in an analogous way to the spin chain, so we'll see that all the global charges of the representation just enter into the asymptotics of these functions, but we'll see that in a moment.
So at weak coupling, you would have only an asymptotic expansion because it looks like these branch points, they move to lambda equals zero?
Yeah, so these branch. So in the weak coupling expansion, these branch points are going to collapse, giving me some effect, essentially giving me a pole, and all these Q functions will have an infinite sequence of poles. Similar. So if you were in the previous lecture, you saw that we had this SL2 spin chain, where we also had this infinite sequence of poles, and these correspond to sort of a weak coupling expansion, a weak coupling limit of this setup.
So maybe you already mentioned, how do you get this? This we know from, say, the literature, weak coupling, but yeah, why is it so like?
Well,
it's an experimental fact, right?
It's an experimental.
To symmetry or something.
I can't argue this right here, why this is the case. I'm telling you this is the definition, but like where it comes from, derivation comes through thermodynamic beta ansatz and like all of this story. But to ask yourself, given n equals 4 Cyprian-Mills, how do you read off this? That's essentially similar to what I was saying to Kevin. You have some infinite dimensional algebra, which is here, and then n equals 4 Cyprian-Mills arises as a picture of representation theory of that algebra, and then somehow all of this should be obvious. But for the moment, starting from n equals 4 Cyprian-Mills, this is not obvious. You need to go through ADS CFT, you need to go to string theory, you do this decompactification, S matrix, blah, blah, TBA. Okay, so let's draw some sheet of these functions. So this is some copy of a complex plane. And all of these functions. So I have some branch points. Let's not do cuts yet. So I have some branch points. Say this is 2g, this is minus 2g, and this is like I, this is I, and I have I, and so on, an infinite number of these branch points. And starting from the argument of thermodynamic beta ansatz, it turns out to be most convenient to connect these branch points through a shortcut. and this is the definition that we will work with. We will assume that all cuts are short. You can also consider long cuts where these branch points, these cuts are stretching from the branch points to infinity. You can, of course, do any type of cut arrangement you want, but this is somehow most convenient. So we can start at some generic point, say this x here. We can go around in some path and then cross underneath the cut, and then we come out onto some new sheet where I again have an infinite number of these branch cuts. So I come out here and now I can do whatever I want. I can go up here, I can go through this cut, come out onto some new sheet, and the story repeats. But importantly, the branch points are quadratic, meaning I start here, I go through this branch cut once, I come out here, and now if I want to go back through again, I end up back on the first sheet. Okay, this is what I mean by saying these branch points are quadratic. Okay, so to solve this system and to read off the conformal dimension, you need to solve for these functions, these 256 different functions, which have this analytic structure. And that seems tremendously complicated, right? And of course, you wouldn't expect it to be trivial, because this system should, at the end of the day, encode the full planar spectrum of n equals 4 super Young Mills. So it has to be at least non-trivial. Okay?
Sorry, do you impose any asymptotics when you go to infinity?
Yeah, I'll come to that in a moment. Yeah. So I'll come to the asymptotics in a moment. For the moment, for now, I just want to just describe the general like sheet structure. So I guess here I cannot display three at the same time. Actually, maybe I can just continue here. Okay, so this is super complicated, but we're lucky, because there is a special sheet in the Riemann surface of these P's, which, as I said, were going to be the building blocks of the full thing. So a special sheet for these PA, which we call the defining sheet. Where we only have a single cut. Okay, so on this sheet, we just have a single cut between minus 2g and plus 2g. We can start somewhere, go around some branch point, go through the cut, and we end up on some new sheet where we get the full set of complications from the infinite set of branch cuts. So yeah, that's why I come out here. Okay, so what is the type of function which has these properties? So I'll write one down because it will be useful for later. I think we can kill this.
Is this single cut an assumption, or do we know that there should always be such a sheet?
So it's an assumption. So from this setup, it's not clear why this would necessarily exist, but it comes from the fact that if you were to start from the long road, starting from thermodynamic beta ansatz, these P's are defined in such a way such that a product of them gives you something with two cuts. So it's a natural assumption that each of them will have one cut. And that's why it's called the defining sheet, because these P's were historically defined in the thermodynamic beta ansatz to precisely have this property, and all of these complications with this infinite number of cuts comes from analyzing the analytic structure of these functions.
Let me make one comment. There are simple quantities like the S matrix that have exactly this property. you have like one or two cards, but then as you crop, you see immediately this infinite power. So there are some very simple physical quantities that you would see. There are other quantities that just have finite number of cards, like the energy as function of U as one card on, or two cards on. And that's it. You crop, you only see two cards, it's a simple torus. But the S matrix, I think it's the simplest physical quantity, which has two cuts, and you cross and you see an infinite top. Mm-hmm.
So I think one last piece of notation. So for a function f of u with branch points, plus minus 2g, I denote f tilde of u as the function obtained by the analytic continuation of this function around this branch point. So I have my function, say f, with my short branch cup between minus 2g and 2g. I start somewhere, I go around, I get some new function, which I denote f tilde. So an example of this type of function, which will play a key role mostly later, but now is a good time to introduce, is this so-called Zhukovsky variable, which is denoted x, so x of u, which in so-called physical kinematics is given by this simple formula. And it's analytic continuation around the branch point of 2g. So x tilde is 1 over x, which you can check by computing the discontinuity across the cot, and so on. Okay. So why this x is going to be important is that when it comes down to actual applications, it's very useful to write a convergent series expansion of these p's in terms of these axes. They turn out to be very useful bases of functions to write these p's. So what we need to do now is consider all of these p functions and consider what happens when we analytically continue through their branch points. But for the moment, this is a point where I really want to restrict to the SL2 sector of n equals 4 super young Mills, just to avoid having to write messy things, which would equally be as well explained in a more simple setup. So this SL2 sector. Where we consider operators, single trace local operators, O, which are some trace, with say S covariant derivatives, acting on some complex scalar Z, L of them, with permutations. So changing how the covariant derivatives are inter-exchanged with the scalars. And in general, and a rep of conformal group, a super conformal group, well, PSU 2, 2/4 is labeled by six Dinkin labels, So we have a delta, which is the conformal dimension, an S1, an S2. So these label ADS5, degrees of freedom, and then a J1, a J2, and a J3, which correspond to S5. But this SL2 sector that we're considering will be where many of these are switched off. And irreducible representations are just labeled by a delta, a conformal dimension, an S, which is exactly this S, 0, an L, which is exactly this L, 0, 0. Okay? And when we restrict for this SL2 sector, so if you imagine SL2, a Hodge dual is essentially trivial because we only have one index to raise and lower with. So the point is that in this SL2 sector, these upper index p functions, which I mentioned, become essentially equal to these lower index p functions. So I had not intended to introduce the upper index p functions at all, but since there was a question about it, in the SL2 sector, we essentially have what I will just call definition in this case, where this is equal to a matrix chi AB, PB. So as I said, for us, this is essentially definition. P with an upper index A is defined to be this, where this chi is a constant matrix. Which is 0, 0, 0, minus 1, and then 1, minus 1, 0, 1, and 0 everywhere else. Okay, so just for example, p with an upper index 1 is minus p with a lower index 4, p with an upper index 2 is p with a lower index 3. Okay, so for us, this is essentially just definition, but I will use this upper index p notation because it will simplify formulas a little bit. Okay, so with this out of the way, what we need to do now is further specify or constrain this analytic structure for these p functions, and in particular say what happens when we cross through these branch points.
You already had a definition before for p upper index. Are they the same? Or?
Right. So my point was that in the special case of the SL2 sector, the definition I wrote earlier reduces simply to this. So in general, p with an upper index a is some complicated trilinear expression in like lower index p's. But in the special case of SL2 sector, it's just a simple like rotation of indices. And for us, this is all we need.
The SL2 sector, why do you need like four different p's?
Instead of just two?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the point is that, well, SL2 sector of n equals 4 super Young Mills indeed defines a closed subsector of the theory, but it's not closed in the sense of physical operators. It is, I mean, the conformal dimension that you get, you will have like information coming from the full n equals 4 super Young Mills.
In addition to the free SL2 that you described.
Sorry, but so the statement about chi means that in order to be compatible with the previous relation, there are some special relation between the q's.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But it's not important. I mean, I only introduced p in the upper index way, the way it was written earlier, just because it would answer the question which was asked. But for us, all we care about is the fact that p with an upper index is just this.
So this relation between the q are true once you choose linking in this.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you say some words about where the simplification? How we see that things simplify when we choose subsectors? It's because some q's become trivial, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we get these extra relations.
Why? Because they scale in a given way that's only compatible with them being constants or something for a given choice of charges. It's related to the boundary conditions that you did not mention yet. Or what?
You can sort of see it at the, you can indeed sort of see it at the level of the boundary conditions. When we look at the large U asymptotics, you see, so for example, in principle, these P's with upper indices would have their own set of behavior at infinity. And then you can explicitly see that when you choose this configuration of charges, that this behavior at infinity of the upper guys precisely matches the behavior at infinity of the lower guys. And then further details, you show that they're in fact equal. So analytic continuation. So analytic continuation is governed by one final set of relations, which is called P mu system. And this mu that we write down is not a new independent guy, but is constructed from this family of Q functions, which we had earlier. But it's not particularly important. It's, for the moment, just some guy who's going to tell us how we analytically continue P. So we have the following, that P, A, analytically continued around the branch point at 2G, is given by a linear combination, so this matrices A, B, which depend on U, P, upper B. And just to make this super clear. And what about this mu? Well, mu is antisymmetric. It has infinite number of cuts. It has determinant 1. And it has unit Pfaffian. So mu 1, 2, mu 3, 4, plus mu 2, 3, mu 1, 4, minus mu 1, 3, mu 2, 4 is equal to 1. And it has two other properties. Which is its own analytic continuation around the branch points at 2G. Is given by just shifting the argument. Okay. And finally, so this mu AB U plus I minus mu, this is not clear, mu AB of U is P A PB tilde minus PB PA tilde. Okay, so I've sort of sold these equations to you as saying that these equations allow you to determine how we analytically can P through the shortcut on the real axis. But sort of the important point, and kind of cool point, is that just these equations allow you to determine the analytic continuation of P through any cut on the full Riemann surface. Okay, which means that through these simple set of relations, you can determine the value of P on any sheet in its Riemann surface, just by knowing the values of P on the first sheet. So through these equations, if you can solve or write an expression for P valid on the first sheet, you've solved the full problem. You know the value of P on any sheet. Okay, and I'm going to show you an example of how this works. I should not move that.
Here on the left.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the top one visible. Okay, that should be okay. Yeah, this can definitely go. My notes so I don't make a typo, because that would be disastrous at this point. That's great. All right. So let's start on the first sheet. Say this is PA. We start from some point, go around branch point, and end up on some new sheet with this infinite sequence of branch points. So we know that because these branch points are quadratic, if I was to go around this branch point again, so I come out here, and now if I go around this thing again, I should end up back where I started. That's kind of boring, so let's try to go through some other cut. We can go here and continue around this branch point, coming out on some new sheet. So now we're coming out here, and we can like end here or whatever. Okay. So my point is, no matter which branch points we want to go around, any of these infinite tower, we can use these equations to write down the value of the function on that sheet at that point in terms of the value of the function on the first sheet. Okay? So let's see how this works. So we're starting on the first sheet. We go to the second sheet. So we have to write down these p mu equations. So we have p a tilde. I can just do, as being mu AB P upper index. Actually, it would be more convenient to write it chi BC PC. So this is just P upper B, using the definition I gave earlier in terms of this chi. OK? So this is the value of the function on the second sheet. So now I want to go around this branch point. So this point branch point is not at 2G. So I cannot use my tilde notation, because tilde universally means going around plus minus 2g. So I want to do a shift. So I have p tilde a of u plus I is mu ab of u plus I chi bc pc of u plus I. OK? So the branch point we want to go around is now the branch point at 2g of this function. So I analytically continue using tilde. So p a tilde of u plus I. And now I'm going around the branch point. So this is mu a b of u plus I tilde chi b c. But p at u plus I has trivial monodromy around 2g, because its branch point was just at 2g. So p of u plus I has a branch point at 2g minus I, but it doesn't have a branch point at 2g. So this has trivial monodromy. OK? And now, because all of our branch points are quadratic, we remember this nice property that mu had, where mu of u plus I is just the analytic continuation of mu around the branch point. So we can use this relation, and we get, so mu AB of u, analytic continuation, because mu AB of u plus I is mu AB tilde, chi BC PC of u plus I. But because all of my branch points are quadratic, this brings me back to the first sheet of this guy, and I just end up with mu AB of u chi BC PC of u plus I. And you can repeat this argument through any set of branch points you like on any sheet of the Riemann surface. You can go to any sheet, go through any branch point, and you can always write the value of the function on that sheet, which is this, in terms of the value of these functions on the very first sheet. Yes?
Sorry to slow you down, but Is there any way to give an idea of where this equation comes from? This piece of equations?
Where which comes from?
Where this system of equations comes from?
Yeah, so at a practical level, all these equations were derived coming through like analyzing thermodynamic beta ansatz, where you start from TBA, you write in terms of Y system, you look at the analytic properties of this thing, you have these T functions like living on this T hook, you write these as Wronskian functions in terms of these Ps, and you know how you understand the analytic properties of these T functions, and from this you deduce the analytic properties of these Ps. So for example, like each of these Ps would be correspondent solutions of the T system, and these mu's would be some other T function which has some known analytic structure, but when written in the language of these P and mu, you get these very simple set of things. But where all these comes from, it all comes from TBA.
So like mu's are some transfer matrices in spin.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
How much information from the system we have here? Because it's not obvious how what you're telling now is related to this system of equations which you have before.
Yeah, right, exactly. So what I mentioned earlier is that this mu is indeed some combination of Q functions, and as a consequence of all of the Q relations, they are used in deriving these formulas. So to give you, as I said, mu is not an independent guy, but everything is contained in the full set of QQ relations. So just to quickly identify for you what mu actually is. So if you remember, I had these Q functions, say, with two indices, A slash I, which satisfied this minus QA slash I minus, which was PA QI, then in fact what you can show is that this mu AB can actually be reconstructed from these Qs the following way, which is QA slash I chi IJ, and then an extra ingredient, which I'm avoiding because I don't want to explain, an extra ingredient, but it's just another constant matrix. Is correct. No chi, just G, J, K, which is some constant matrix, Q, B, slash, J. So this is some constant matrix.
So it's G, I, K, I guess.
G, I, K.
So it's some quadratic combination of
Q. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then these relations with the random-like properties together with QQ relations give me these relations.
And basically, analytic properties you derive first for Q functions, and then you can like.
Yeah, then from there you can derive the analytic properties of these mu's as well. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so the main point. So today we're running to 11:15 or 11?
11:15.
Okay, perfect.
You just say that this derivation is a nightmare. So, no one knows this derivation. I don't know this derivation.
I don't know this derivation.
Yeah. So the step from TBA to this is conceptually kind of clean, but it's awful. There should be a much cleaner way of understanding what the physical meaning of these equations or good theory meaning of these equations.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we could bypass all that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's too painful to be the way to go.
And so like a kind of side remark is that in the language of like ADS3, which people are looking at now, I mean, TBA was only formulated very recently. People conjectured these equations for like this ADS3 background based on analogy with this thing and kind of hope it works and you can check. And then people propose TBA and then it's still not clear if these things are actually the same thing. And this is the full derivation of this thing is not the way to go. I mean, my own personal ambition is to have some like representation theory understanding of this thing, some infinite dimension algebra where all of this is just a simple statement of commutative subalgebras and so on. But it's... we're quite far from there. Okay, so. Main point, P mu system. Encodes the full. Planar spectrum. Of n equals 4 through p angles. Okay, so far all I've done is give you a bunch of equations, told you that they have some fancy analytic structure, and made some comments based on that. But at the end of the day, you want to compute a number, right? You want to compute, say, conformal dimension of some irreducible representation corresponding to some single trace local operators. So how do you do this? And then the main point is that in exactly the same way as in the Heisenberg spin chain, and the reason why I formulated it as so is that all information on the quantum numbers of representation are encoded in the asymptotics of these p and mu functions. So in particular, for single trace local operators, first of all p and mu have power-like behavior at infinity. As u goes to infinity. Okay. And of course, you can ask, well, okay, what happens if you relax this power-like condition? And of course, then you will end up with different classes of observables, for example, some cusped Wilson loop, and so on, if you allow, for example, these mu's to have, for example, instead of power-like behavior at infinity, some trigonometric behavior, and that will actually be very useful and something we will use in the next lecture when we look at some explicit example. But okay, so how do the quantum numbers enter? So I will just write down the behavior for the p's because they'll be most useful for the next one, and the mu's, I'll just give a schematic overview. So the point is that this pa, p1 is some constant a1, like we had in the spin chain, times u to the minus l over 2 minus 1. P2 is a2 u to the minus l over 2. P3 is a3 u to the l over 2 minus 1. And P4 is again a4 u to the l over 2. Okay, so where's the conformal dimension? So as a consequence of all the QQ relations and so on, what we can show, actually, I probably need the full board for this instead of this small section. Yeah, this can go.
You can raise this.
This one?
Raise this one. You'll have one.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So delta is contained in these a1, a2, a3, and a4. So a1, a4 can be shown to be equal to minus I over 16 L, L plus 1, and then minus delta plus L minus S plus 2 minus delta plus L plus S times delta plus L minus S plus 2, and then delta plus L plus S, and then similarly another relation which is more or less the same for A2 and A3, which I won't write explicitly. Because it won't add value, it's very similar to this, just some different arrangement of the charges, L, S, plus, minus, and 2, and so on. And finally, delta is also contained in the asymptotics of these mu's, in particular. So mu AB is something which encodes, for example, some function of, say, delta L and S. So, for example, mu 1, 2 is u to the delta minus L, for example.
Before, in simpler examples, energy was computed via the d log of the q function evaluated at a certain point. But why is it contained in the asymptotics?
Because in the case of the spin chain, the Hamiltonian was not a global symmetry generator of the integrable system. It was like an extra guy. So we had global SU2 symmetry and then Hamiltonian added on top. Whereas here, the Hamiltonian, which is the dilatation operator of n equals 4, is one of the global symmetry generators of the algebra. And that's why it's included in the asymptotics. It essentially just corresponds to a different role played by the Hamiltonian in both cases. In this case, it belongs to the global symmetry algebra. In the SU2 case, it didn't.
In SL2, it did.
So what do you mean in SL2 it did?
In the SL2 spin chain,
yeah.
You could say the Hamiltonian is part of the SL2.
Mm. Oh, yeah, because you write it as some like gamma function of like spin generators and so on. You mean in this way?
The SL2 contains spin generators, right?
Yeah.
Plus or minus L0, the Hamiltonian is L0, right?
So you mean specifically the SL2 spin chain you get from, like, say, constructing an R matrix? Oh, yeah, well, there's some formula. Yeah, it's like gamma function of L0 times L0 plus 1 or something like this. It's like the quadratic, it's essentially the quadratic Casimir.
No, I guess what I'm saying is that, let me say it differently. Maybe I'm just being confused. The SL2 spin chain is the weak coupling limit of this, right? So the energy in the weak coupling limit should also be possible to express as derivative at I over 2, of course.
Yeah.
Right? And it's true, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
At weak coupling. But
yeah.
At weak coupling. I think the point is that this cuts close at weak coupling. And so before at finite coupling, you need to cross the cut at I over 2, plus minus 2g, and then go to infinity, and you read off the energy. When the cut closes, the energy now is on the cut, because it's the entrance to the sheet where you would read off the energy asymptotic.
I see.
So you needed to go there and then go to infinity to read off the energy, and now this cut closes. So the closest thing you can do is take a residue there.
I see.
You need a contour integral there, you could cross the cut and block this contour and go to infinity. Now the cut disappeared, all you were left was a contour integral around that point, and then like the closest thing you have.
So I see.
Well, this point at I over 2, where we are doing, where the cuts were. So it's the closest thing we can do to crossing the cuts is going to the poles.
Sorry. But which sheet of mu becomes Q at the coupling?
And the defining sheet of mu.
Defining sheet.
Yeah.
So I don't see why you need to cross any cut.
Because those cuts, those Q functions were not P.
Mu. The Q function of SL2 is mu in the defining sheet.
Yes.
And mu in the defining sheet already has the asymptotics. So.
I mean, for me, I would not need to compute weak coupling SL2 energy by crossing any cuts. I would use the fact that at weak coupling, this mu, as Alex said, like degenerates into the Q function of the SL2 Baxter equation, and then I would have the usual formula for the energy and compute.
But the way you would derive that the energy is related to something at I over 2, I thought comes because the behavior on the second sheet as you cross I over 2 is trivial. So going to infinity on the second sheet is the same as just measuring the residue around I over 2.
But why do you want to go to the second sheet?
Because at finite coupling, I thought the definition of all the way that L's and the deltas appear are in asymptotics of functions.
Yes.
It's a consequence. That's the primary definition, right? And then it follows as a consequence that in the SL2 sector, you can read off as the prefectors like this, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because they came before. The delta was not in the prefector, right? It was in the asymptotics of some other set of functions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then, because we are in ESL2, we can show that this implies this.
Yeah.
And it also implies that at weak coupling, you could also read it from the pole that I overtook.
Oh, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
But the primary definition is about going to infinity in different sheets for different functions, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so confused. It's about going to infinity in the defining sheet.
To read this L, but not to read delta. No, but that's not an exponent, that's a prefactor. There are Q functions that behave as U to the delta, not U to the L. There are the Qs behave as U to the delta, not the P's. Right? There are some functions that are more associated to the sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Some functions that are more associated to ADS,
mm-hmm.
and some functions know about the Cartan charges of the sphere. Some Q functions asymptotical know about the Cartan charges of ADS, and both are coupled to each other because they are not independent. And indeed, the ones that whose powers know about S5, the prefactors know about ADS, and vice versa, right?
Mm-hmm.
The powers will know about ADS. Prefactors will know about this. Anyway, sorry. Go on.
Well, I think in that case I can just finish. There's one other slide, but I can just do it in the next one, and it will fit in. So that's like the definition of this one. So I'll finish there.
Okay. So let's thank Paul.